2 days later, messages sent to Japanese diplomatic and consular posts at Hong Kong, Singapore, Batavia, Manila, Washington, and London were intercepted and decoded. They called for the diplomats to destroy most of their codes and ciphers immediately, and to burn all of their important confidential and secret documents. Around that time, the FBI also intercepted a telephone call from a cook at the Japanese consulate in Hawaii to someone in Honolulu, reporting in great excitement that the officials there were burning all major documents. The assistant head of the main unit of Army Intelligence, Lieutenant Colonel George W. Bicknell, brought one of the intercepted messages to his boss as he was preparing to go to dinner with the head of the Army's Hawaiian Department. It was late afternoon on Saturday, December 6th, the day before the attack. Bicknell's higher-up took 5 minutes to consider the message, then dismissed it and went to eat. With events so foreboding, when considered in hindsight, why hadn't anyone privy to this information seen the attack coming? In any complex string of events in which each event unfolds with some element of uncertainty, there is a fundamental asymmetry between past and future. This asymmetry has been the subject of scientific study ever since Boltzmann made his statistical analysis of the molecular processes responsible for the properties of fluids. Imagine, for example, a dye molecule floating in a glass of water. The molecule will, like one of Brown's granules, follow a drunkard's walk. But even that aimless movement makes progress in some direction. If you wait 3 hours, for example, the molecule will typically have traveled about an inch from where it started. Suppose that at some point the molecule moves to a position of significance, and so finally attracts our attention. As many did after Pearl Harbor, we might look for the reason why that unexpected event occurred. Now, suppose we dig into the molecule's past. Suppose, in fact, we trace the record of all its collisions. We will indeed discover how first this bump from a water molecule and then that one propelled the dye molecule on its zigzag path from there to here. In hindsight, in other words, we can clearly explain why the past of the dye molecule developed as it did. But the water contains many other water molecules that could have been the ones that interacted with the dye molecule. To predict the dye molecule's path beforehand would have therefore required us to calculate the paths and mutual interactions of all those potentially important water molecules. That would have involved an almost unimaginable number of mathematical calculations, far greater in scope and difficulty than the list of collisions needed to understand the past. In other words, the movement of the dye molecule was virtually impossible to predict before the fact, even though it was relatively easy to understand afterward. That fundamental asymmetry is why, in day-to-day life, the past often seems obvious, even when we could not have predicted it. It's why weather forecasters can tell you the reasons why 3 days ago the cold front moved like this, and yesterday the warm front moved like that, causing it to rain on your romantic garden wedding. But the same forecasters are much less successful at knowing how the fronts will behave 3 days hence, and at providing the warning you would have needed to get that big tent ready. Or consider a game of chess. Unlike card games, chess involves no explicit random element. And yet, there is uncertainty because neither player knows for sure what his or her opponent will do next. If the players are expert, at most points in the game it may be possible to see a few moves into the future. If you look out any further, the uncertainty will compound, and no one will be able to say with any confidence exactly how the game will turn out. On the other hand, looking back, it is usually easy to say why each player made the moves he or she made. This, again, is a probabilistic process whose future is difficult to predict but whose past is easy to understand. The same thing is true of the stock market. Consider, for instance, the performance of mutual funds. As I mentioned in Chapter 9, it is common when choosing a mutual fund to look at past performance. Indeed, it is easy to find nice, orderly patterns when looking back. Take, for instance, a graph of the performance of 800 mutual fund managers over the 5-year period 1991 through 1995. On the vertical axis would be plotted the fund's gains or losses relative to the average fund of the group. In other words, a return of 0% means the fund's performance was average for this 5-year period. Now, on the horizontal axis would be plotted the manager's relative rank from the number 1 performer to the number 800 performer. To look up the performance of, say, the 100th most successful fund manager in a given 5-year period, you find the point on the graph corresponding to the spot labeled 100 on the horizontal axis. Any analyst, no doubt, could give a number of convincing reasons why the top managers represented here succeeded, why the bottom ones failed, and why the curve should take this shape. And whether or not we take the time to follow such analyses in detail, few are the investors who would choose a fund that has performed 10% below average in the past 5 years over a fund that has done 10% better than average. It is easy, looking at the past, to construct such nice graphs and neat explanations. But this logical picture of events is just an illusion of hindsight, with little relevance for predicting future events. Let's take that same graph and compare how the same funds, still ranked in order of their performance in the initial 5-year period, performed in the next 5-year period. In other words, you could maintain the rank based on the period 1991 to 1995, but display the return the funds achieved in 1996 to 2000. If the past were a good indicator of the future, the funds I considered in the period 1991 to 1995 would have had more or less the same relative performance in 1996 to 2000. That is, if the winners continue to do better than the others, and the losers worse, this graph should be nearly identical to the last. Instead, the order of the past dissolves when extrapolated to the future, and the graph ends up looking like random noise. People systematically fail to see the role of chance in the success of ventures and in the success of people like the equity fund manager Bill Miller. And we unreasonably believe that the mistakes of the past must be consequences of ignorance or incompetence and could have been remedied by further study and improved insight. That's why, for example, in spring 2007, when the stock of Merrill Lynch was trading around $95 a share, its CEO, E. Stanley O'Neill, could be celebrated as the risk-taking genius responsible. And in the fall of 2007, after the credit market collapsed, derided as the risk-taking cowboy responsible, and promptly fired. We afford automatic respect to superstar business moguls, politicians, and actors, and to anyone flying around in a private jet, as if their accomplishments must reflect unique qualities not shared by those forced to eat commercial airline food. And we place too much confidence in the overly precise predictions of people, political pundits, financial experts, business consultants, who claim a track record demonstrating expertise. One large publishing company I'm familiar with went to great pains to develop 1-year, 3-year, and 5-year plans for its educational software division. There were high-paid consultants, lengthy marketing meetings, late-night financial analysis sessions, long off-site afternoon powwows. In the end, hunches were turned into formulas claiming the precision of several decimal places, and wild guesses were codified as likely outcomes. When, in the first year, certain products didn't sell as well as expected, or others sold better than projected, reasons were found, and the appropriate employees blamed or credited, as if the initial expectations had been meaningful. The next year saw a series of unforeseen price wars started by two competitors. The year after that, the market for educational software collapsed. As the uncertainty compounded, the 3-year plan never had a chance to succeed, and the 5-year plan, polished and precise as a diamond, was spared any comparison with performance, for by then virtually everyone in the division had moved on to greener pastures. Historians, whose profession is to study the past, are as wary as scientists of the idea that events unfold in a manner that can be predicted. In fact, in the study of history, the illusion of inevitability has such serious consequences that it is one of the few things that both conservative and socialist historians can agree on. The socialist historian Richard Henry Taney, for example, put it like this. Historians give an appearance of inevitability by dragging into prominence the forces which have triumphed and thrusting into the background those which they have swallowed up. And the historian Roberta Wohlstetter, who received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from Ronald Reagan, said it this way. After the event, of course, a signal is always crystal clear. We can now see what disaster it was signaling. But before the event, it is obscure and pregnant with conflicting meanings. In some sense, this idea is encapsulated in the cliché that hindsight is always 20/20, but people often behave as if the adage weren't true. In government, for example, a should-have-known-it blame game is played after every tragedy. In the case of Pearl Harbor and the September 11th attacks, the events leading up to the attack, when we look back at them, certainly seem to point in an obvious direction. Yet, as with the dye molecule, the weather, or the chess game, if you start well before the fact and trace events forward, the feeling of inevitability quickly dissolves. For one thing, in addition to the intelligence reports I quoted, there was a huge amount of useless intelligence, with each week bringing new reams of sometimes alarming or mysterious messages and transcripts that would later prove misleading or insignificant. And even if we focused on the reports that hindsight tells us were important, before the attack there existed for each of those reports a reasonable alternative explanation that did not point toward a surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. For example, the request to divide Pearl Harbor into five areas was similar in style to the other requests that had gone to Japanese agents in Panama, Vancouver, San Francisco, and Portland, Oregon. The loss of radio contact was also not unheard of, and had in the past often meant simply that the warships were in home waters and communicating via telegraphic landlines. Moreover, even if you believed a broadening of the war was impending, many signs pointed toward an attack elsewhere, in the Philippines, on the Thai Peninsula, or on Guam, for example. There were not, to be sure, as many red herrings as water molecules encountered by a molecule of dye, but there were enough to obscure a clear vision of the future. After Pearl Harbor, seven committees of the U.S. Congress delved into the process of discovering why the military had missed all the signs of a coming attack. Army Chief of Staff General George Marshall, for one, drew heavy criticism for a May 1941 memo to President Roosevelt in which he wrote that the island of Oahu, due to its fortification, its garrison, and its physical characteristic, is believed to be the strongest fortress in the world, and reassured the president that, in case of attack, enemy forces would be intercepted within 200 miles of their objective by all types of bombardment. General Marshall was no fool, but neither did he have a crystal ball. The study of randomness tells us that the crystal ball view of events is possible, unfortunately, only after they happen. And so we believe we know why a film did well. A candidate won an election, a storm hit, a stock went down, a soccer team lost, a new product failed, or a disease took a turn for the worse. But such expertise is empty, in the sense that it is of little use in predicting when a film will do well. A candidate will win an election, a storm will hit, a stock will go down, a soccer team will lose, a new product will fail, or a disease will take a turn for the worse. It is easy to concoct stories explaining the past or to become confident about dubious scenarios for the future. That there are traps in such endeavors doesn't mean we should not undertake them. But we can work to immunize ourselves against our errors of intuition. We can learn to view both explanations and prophecies with skepticism. We can focus on the ability to react to events, rather than relying on the ability to predict them, on qualities like flexibility, confidence, courage, and perseverance. And we can place more importance on our direct impressions of people than on their well-trumpeted past accomplishments. In these ways, we can resist forming judgments in our automatic, deterministic framework. In March 1979, another famously unanticipated chain of events occurred, this one at a nuclear power plant in Pennsylvania. It resulted in a partial meltdown of the core, in which the nuclear reaction occurs, threatening to release into the environment an alarming dose of radiation. The mishap began when a cup or so of water emerged through a leaky seal from a water filter called a polisher. The leaked water entered a pneumatic system that drives some of the plant's instruments, tripping two valves. The tripped valves shut down the flow of cold water to the plant's steam generator, the system responsible for removing the heat generated by the nuclear reaction in the core. An emergency water pump then came on, but a valve in each of its two pipes had been left in a closed position after maintenance 2 days earlier. The pumps, therefore, were pumping water uselessly toward a dead end. Moreover, a pressure relief valve also failed, as did a gauge in the control room that ought to have shown that the valve was not working. Viewed separately, each of the failures was a type considered both commonplace and acceptable. Polisher problems were not unusual at the plant, nor were they normally very serious, with hundreds of valves regularly being opened or closed in a nuclear power plant. Leaving some valves in the wrong position was not considered rare or alarming. And the pressure relief valve was known to be somewhat unreliable and had failed at times without major consequences in at least 11 other power plants. Yet strung together, these failures made the plant seem as if it had been run by the Keystone Cops. And so after the incident at Three Mile Island came many investigations and much laying of blame, as well as a very different consequence. That string of events spurred Yale sociologist Charles Perrow to create a new theory of accidents, in which is codified the central argument of this chapter. In complex systems, among which I count our lives, we should expect that minor factors we can usually ignore will, by chance, sometimes cause major incidents. In his theory, Perrow recognized that modern systems are made up of thousands of parts, including fallible human decision-makers, which interrelate in ways that are, like Laplace's atoms, impossible to track and anticipate individually. Yet, one can bet on the fact that just as atoms executing a drunkard's walk will eventually get somewhere, so too will accidents eventually occur. Called normal accident theory, Perrow's doctrine describes how that happens, how accidents can occur without clear causes, without those glaring errors and incompetent villains sought by corporate or government commissions. But although normal accident theory is a theory of why, inevitably, things sometimes go wrong, it could also be flipped around to explain why, inevitably, they sometimes go right. For in a complex undertaking, no matter how many times we fail, if we keep trying, there is often a good chance we will eventually succeed. In fact, economists like W. Brian Arthur argue that a concurrence of minor factors can even lead companies with no particular edge to come to dominate their competitors. In the real world, he wrote, if several similar-sized firms entered a market together, small fortuitous events, unexpected orders, chance meetings with buyers, managerial whims, would help determine which ones received early sales and, over time, which came to dominate. Economic activity is determined by individual transactions that are too small to foresee, and these small random events could accumulate and become magnified by positive feedbacks over time. The same phenomenon has been noticed by researchers in sociology. One group, for example, studied the buying habits of consumers in what sociologists call the cultural industries, books, film, art, and music. The conventional marketing wisdom in those fields is that success is achieved by anticipating consumer preference.